Hi, I'm Clarabelle A. Ortega, author of Ghost Squad.
And I'm Kat Cho, author of Wicked Fox and Vicious Spirits, and this is Ride or Die.
Pow, pow, pow.
And we are back again. We're bringing it at ya. Everyone wave your hands in the air. Okay.
See, when you say back again, I think tag team back again. Different tag team, different back agains. That's my back again.
I think Backstreet's back. All right.
That's a good one too.
That's a good one. We didn't even go on break. I don't know why we're so excited. I think it's because it's been a while since we recorded, actually.
It's because we're dumb.
It's because we're amazing and we love each other. Okay. Let's get in it. Do we have housekeeping? I don't actually think so. I think we're pretty clean right now.
Yeah. No housekeeping. Just buy our books.
Yeah. Buy our books. Buy sign our up books. For Patreon.
Yeah. Sign up subscribe, for Patreon.
Rate and subscribe.
Smash that subscribe button. No, this is not YouTube.
This is not YouTube, but we do love that channel. I don't know why I won't say the name of a thing as if it's like trademarked, and sometimes I will, but that's just, I don't know. My brain doesn't work in a linear fashion. No, but we were just talking about something that's a little bit in the past, but still prevalent and should be discussed to this day, which is the hashtag publishing paid me, created by L.L. McKinney and Toshio Yamaguchi. Clarabelle, why don't you tell everyone how Publishing Paid Me started and why?
So it was basically, it started during sort of the height of what was going on with the protests for Black Lives Matter. And Tochi and L started this hashtag for transparency to show sort of the inequality that exists between Black authors and like white counterparts in publishing, and how there's a huge discrepancy in how much Black authors get paid versus white authors. And there were a lot of people sharing their advances on Twitter. And if you're not in publishing, if you've never sort of if you don't know why that's a big deal, it's because we really usually don't share that kind of information publicly. Like even between friends, it's like sometimes a taboo thing to be like, ooh, how much did you get? Like, what was your advance type of thing? Which can be really not good because just like in any like employment situation, if you don't know what your colleagues are making, you're a lot more likely to be taken advantage of. So it was a movement to sort of foster more transparency and to help Black authors find out what they were getting paid, get paid more, and hopefully that would spread throughout the industry so that all authors of color can also benefit from it eventually. But the main focus and the whole point of it was to talk about Black authors' pay disparity specifically. And it was a wild couple of days.
Oh, my goodness. We were all just sitting here just watching and being shocked because we were trained to not talk about advances, like you were saying, Clarabelle. And we were also, like, so surprised that people voluntarily, such big people voluntarily gave their advance numbers, which I am grateful for. I'm grateful that really big white authors came out and supported the movement and said their advances. I do think there was a little bit of an interesting, like, rewarding people, how people were rewarded when they, like, come out to support things is sometimes allies get rewarded more, you know, than the original people. But that's neither here nor there about this conversation. That can be a different pre-chat. I am grateful that they came forward. And also, you know, some people, like, it does show that, like, at the beginning of their career, like, they didn't actually get paid that much. Like, Scott Westerfeld shared his advance, and at this point, like, all in all, in total, he's getting 7-figure advances for some of his series, but he started out, I think, getting, like, a 17,000 advance.
Yeah, so it was a build. It wasn't, like, like a lot from Jump. And then we have people like, I already forgot the name, Chip something something.
Oh, yes.
That one book who got like a bajillion dollars.
He got 800,000 for one book.
For one book. It was like a literary book. And I think it's normal for you to feel frustration towards the system, but I think it's really bad when we start like attacking the authors that are sharing
for sure
that information, because at the end of the day, them sharing is helping us. They don't have to share. It's shitty if they don't share, but they certainly don't have to share. It's their private business, you know. And them sharing those numbers with us is really helpful, because that's how we gauge, you know, like the disparity. And there was like a lot of like I understand getting mad at something like that, and reading the book and not finding any merit in it, I'm sure, like, that is really frustrating. But none of us would turn down that kind of money.
Exactly.
Like, you, I just, mean, like, you happen to write a book and it does well, you don't plan on that happening. And obviously there's a lot that goes into it. He's like a white cis man. He's in a position to like get the most money, but we know that already, right? We know that those are the people who get the most money. So I think that there's something to be said about expressing your frustration but not being necessarily cruel towards the individual author. I think our error is, it's better when we point it at the systems that make this kind of thing possible.
Agreed.
It's not gonna do anything for us to get mad at
Chip. For sure. But like, we like you're saying, like, we should get mad. The system is really messed up, and like, there are a lot of think pieces that came out around this. We'll post some of them in the show notes. And there was a lot of people like breaking down, like, okay, you're seeing all these tweets. Let me tell you what these numbers mean. Let me tell you what these patterns mean. And I think the most important one for people to see are the ones where they talk about profit and loss. Reports. So a P&L is what a publisher writes up in order to decide how much of an advance a book is worth. P&L meaning profit and loss. And they, each publisher does have like a formula. They have like an actual like spreadsheet thing that they plug in numbers. So it sounds scientific, right? It's actually not that scientific. Let me break it down for you people.
It's fake science.
It's fake, everybody. Don't trust it. It's pretty much that the numbers, once the numbers are in, yeah, of course, it's science, it's math. But to get the numbers is the most bullshit of bullshits. It's pretty much you see a book and you think, okay, what can I compare this book to know how much it's worth? If it's a fantasy, they're obviously going to look at other fantasies. They're going to look at ones that are recent. They're going to hopefully find ones that are in-house because they have the numbers. But sometimes they look at comps that are outside of the house. But they'll try to comp it for something as accurate as they think is possible. And they'll plug in those numbers in order to anticipate how much they think this book is going to sell. So the problem with this is that if there is a white dystopian fantasy with people with magical powers and royalty, they could be like, this is just like the Red Queen. I'm going to plug in the numbers for the Red Queen and see how much of advances is worth. The Red Queen sold a boatload of books in its first printing. So that's really good numbers. That book is probably going to get a really good advance because they have that amazing comp in-house, right? But what if they were like, oh, this is a fantasy, a dystopian fantasy with royalty and people with magical powers, but it's based on like South Asian culture, and we don't really know what to do with that, and we've never heard of a book like that. We could comp it to the Red Queen, but let's actually comp it to this mid-list South Asian contemporary fantasy, because that's the closest we can get to. And they put in those numbers, and that book obviously is just not going to get as much of an advance because they couldn't find like a good comp for it. So they went digging for an obscure one, and then they, you know, decide that it's worth less. And this is a pattern, and it is a cycle that continues on itself, because as long as they continue to pay books by Black, Indigenous, and other POC authors less than the comps for the future books will continue to be based on lower comps, if that makes sense. So it's like, as long as you keep on paying us nothing, you're going to continue paying us nothing in the future because that's what you're comping it to. So get your shit together, publishing, is pretty much the message here. Yeah. And get comps that are, and buy more books so that you can get more comps to begin with. And then your P&L will be slightly more accurate, even though the P&L will still be complete bullshit.
Right. And also put effort behind those books too, right? Because like they, it just becomes, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, you don't put, like, I remember when Red Queen came out, it was the same year I started working at conferences, and I was like, whoa, whatever this book is, it's a big deal, because it was everywhere. Every single show that I went to, and I went to, like, my first year working at my old job, I went to, like, 10 shows, including international shows, and it was everywhere. So I was like, this book is definitely going to be like a huge success. It must be so good because everyone's talking about it. I didn't know much about publishing then, you know. I didn't know that it was just like the publisher pushing the book. And it's like, obviously you can't have a huge poster for every single book that you buy. But I feel like so often books by people of color are left behind. And I think they're left behind because people don't know what to do with them, because they don't understand them in the same way that we do. They don't get how to market them. And I think that that's because there's not a lot of people of color in publishing to begin with and in positions of power. And I'll give one really good example, which is DJ from Wednesday Books, who is so incredible at his job. And I feel like, because he's a person of color, he has so many different experiences to pull from, and he's able to see the appeal in things. And I'm really glad that people like him are moving up in publishing, and I hope that that continues throughout, because we have to have all of these different kinds of visions and kinds of people at the publishing house in order to get these books out here. I feel like the only way that we're going to get the effort behind these books and like people with the vision and like to understand the audience that it would go to is to have a lot of different kinds of people working in publishing. You know what I mean? Like the other day I was sort of panicking because the YA that I've been working on, my magic system is like, to put it quite bluntly, based on the hood, like where I grew up. Like the magic comes from acrylic nails, the magic comes from domino games, the magic is based in all of the things that I grew up with. And I'm like, to me, this is really freaking cool, but will somebody who didn't grow up poor understand it? Will somebody who didn't grow up in the kinds of places I grew up in understand it? And that's like another barrier, right? Like a socioeconomic barrier as well, because it's so hard to be poor and work in publishing because you don't get paid much and you have to be in New York and all this crazy stuff. So there's so many different factors that go into it that like we really have to work from the ground up to restructure everything about publishing and really make an effort to have more people of color in place and to, for lack of like a better system, get people out who are like racist and who aren't willing to work on their biases, and the people who are, get them training and just really, really work on it. It's hard work. It's hard work to undo years of biases. And I think the reason why it's so hard is because it's people who believe they're good people and who deep down they're trying to do good things, and they don't realize that they're not always doing good things because they have unexamined prejudices within themselves. And like we all do, right? We all have those things. So as long as those things exist, like we're always going to be at a disadvantage. Like look at the freaking experiment that they were doing with how pictures are cropped on Twitter, how like the crop always recognizes white faces over anything darker.
Oh, I haven't heard that.
Oh, that's, man, you have so to see it. So they did it with a picture of Mitch McConnell, which I hate you, Mitch McConnell. You are an asshole. And
we're going to lose so many listeners
now. I don't care. They can go. And Obama. And it was like a long picture, right? And like on the two ends, it would have like Obama and then like Mitch McConnell in the middle, and then like it switched it for the next one. So it would have like Mitch McConnell on the two far ends and Obama in the middle. And in every instance, it centered on Mitch's picture. And they've done it with a lot of different pictures, and it keeps focusing on the white face.
Well, I think it's also because we, like, people don't know how to light black faces either for pictures or for film. Like, I mean, they don't know how to do the lighting.
That's part of it, but I think that the algorithms on social media are very clearly skewed towards lighter skin. And
listen,
and
everything saying, like, is racist.
Right. Not even on social media do authors of color, particularly black colors, particularly darker skinned black people, have an even playing field.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is uneven, and it's
even AI is against you.
It's very frustrating, and I just really want, I'm hoping that publishing, you know, huge thank yous to Ellen Tochi for spearheading this, because when they do something like this, it's gonna help all of us, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I really hope that it starts to inspire change, and that it also starts to let people see that we're capable of writing these tropes that have been around for a long time, and like let us get our shot at it without like expecting us to write something that's near perfect. Like, give us a shot to be mediocre and just good, you know what I mean? Like,
and
like
still get paid.
Like, we really have to write these like amazing, when we see the books by people of color get published, they're doing so well. It's because we have to be so good in order to get to that step. Exceptional. And it's like, you have to be exceptional. You have to have a brand new take on tropes that white people get to do over and over again. And that's a form of prejudice as well when it comes to like querying and like buying books. And I just really hope people examine that and just pay us more, please. We cannot create if we're like not able to eat.
Yeah. I think like what kind of plays into this, what kind of plays into this whole entire situation as well, is the fact that it's not just about the struggles that you can see and that you could imagine, you know, as someone who has always had a place of privilege, which I feel like I never grew up hungry, right? So I do have some privilege, right? I've never had to be like, I'm so hungry that I literally can't think. I can't do my homework. I can't, you know, do these things. Mm-hmm. And some kids have grown up like that.
Right.
So it's that kind of a mindset of being like, it's not just that, you know, Black, Indigenous, and people of color are being paid less, so we have to like get a second job. It's like, we're being paid less, plus we're dealing with microaggressions, plus we're worrying about how much less we're getting paid for the next paycheck. Plus we're worrying about how much less marketing we're going to get, which affects how much less we get paid for the next paycheck. And then the anxiety and stress of all that magnify and build up on each other, as well as the fact that we're expected to educate everybody else around us about the fact that we're worrying about these things in the first place. And it just like creates more and more and more emotional barriers, mental barriers. And it does. It adds up on each other. Like, I know that individually, each of these little instances are could be overcome on their own, right? But like, when it's all piled on top, it's really bad. And it's kind of like, you don't know where to even freaking start. Like, where do you start digging yourself out of this? Because there's just so much to deal with. And that's, I think, the big issue. And I know it feels like you're constantly being inundated with all of these conversations and with different reasons why we're being oppressed. Like, oh my God, another reason? But like, that's how we feel too.
Yeah.
And I was thinking when we were deciding, like, what are we going to talk about today on our pre-chat? And I was like, oh, is it bad that we're talking about yet another thing about the inequality and inequity within publishing? And yeah, exactly what Claribel just said. No, it's not, because all of these add up. All of these are valid conversations and parts of our identity as two POC authors, as well as the fact that they're ongoing issues within publishing. Like, us not talking about it isn't going to make it go away. But hopefully us talking about it does give you a little bit more insight. And that's what we're, that's all we're really hoping for.
And like, and on top of like, if you're worried and like stressed out about like the political climate, like just add that to the list of things that we're also worried about. Like,
yeah, right.
we're worried about all of the things affecting our career, plus everything that's going on with politics. It's like, it's a wonder that any of us can still write. Like, I'm really proud of us because like we are doing it. Like, despite everything, think of all of the people of color whose books have done really well this year, all the Black authors whose books have hit the list for the first time. Mm-hmm. I'm really proud of every single one of us because we've gone through hell and we're still here and we're doing the damn thing. And like, that's something worth celebrating in this fucking hellhole of a time.
Isn't that right? Totally. But at this, yeah, also like, hopefully, even if you're not a BIPOC author or an LGBTQ author or a disabled author or any kind of marginalization, this conversation about P&L statements has been helpful for you, because they really are,
it's good to have the
so
insight.
Confusing and weird.
Yeah.
And there's like, I mean, there's a whole other conversation about how, you know, the higher paid books are considered more worthy of marketing. So it's like, not just that you're getting paid less. It's just that you're like, okay, so you're going to give me no marketing, but that's a different conversation as well. Yeah. There's a lot that it's tiers. It's like, it's steps. They all pile onto each other.
Yep.
So, but yeah. Yay. Welcome to publishing, everyone. Take a seat. You're going to need it. You need your rest.
We have snacks.
We do have snacks and water.
When an enemy hires Arden Finch without realizing who she is, Arden risks everything to claim her forbidden elemental magic. Set in a supernatural North Carolina, Elemental is book one in a diverse new urban fantasy series. Kirkus Reviews calls Elemental a genuine page-turner and gave the sequel, Eldritch Sparks, a starred review. Find Elemental at your favorite bookstore or save 10% when you buy directly from the author with code WOD10 at whwrites.com/shop.
This week's guest is Chloe Gong. She is a student at the University of Pennsylvania studying English and International Relations. During her breaks, she's either at home in New Zealand or visiting her many relatives in Shanghai. Chloe has been known to mysteriously appear when Romeo and Juliet is one of Shakespeare's best plays and doesn't deserve its slander in pop culture, is chanted into a mirror 3 times. Hi, Chloe. How are you?
I'm good. Hello. How are you guys? Thank you for having me here.
Of course.
So
I love your bio.
To have
it's
you.
So funny.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But I was just like, okay. I totally get it. I'm with it. Also,
yeah, I had a chuckle to myself when I was writing it.
I feel like I need to give you total kudos for juggling school, writing and debuting, and the world currently at the same time.
Oh, the entire world. Yeah, it's a struggle, but we're getting there one day at a time.
We truly are. We really are. Do you want to kind of give us a little bit of a breakdown about how you fell in love with writing, how you got your agent, how you got this book deal for this fantastic sounding YA book? Just give us the total story.
Yes. Okay. The total story. I'll completely rewind back to the day I was Lenora. I won't do that. I started writing at the last, okay, how does this go? When I finished the first year of high school is when I first started writing, because I was so bored is how I got my start. So I always, The way that I got inspired for the first book I wrote was actually I was in China visiting my grandparents, and because of the Great Firewall there and everything and how social media is completely blocked, because like, but when I was in high school, I was already addicted to social media because that's just how this generation is, I guess. So I couldn't go on like Facebook or anything. So I was just so bored that I decided to write because I loved reading so much, and I'd run out of books because I couldn't bring that much with me. So I literally just decided to write on the notes app in my iPad, and I was just kind of like, it was really strange in the sense that when I started writing, I didn't have the same like attitude that I do now, where like I get an idea and I try to like carry it out through the end. Like back then it was almost kind of like, I'm just gonna tell myself the story to like entertain me. Like I don't really care where it goes. I don't really care if I can finish it. I don't even really care about like where the general trajectory is going. I just want to entertain myself like for the time being. So like that was kind of the way I started. And just because I had that like, I'm only gonna entertain myself kind of attitude, like it was so easy in a sense to just like write down like absolute like just a mess of a story that honestly like didn't make any logical sense really, but like it was still a story in the end. So that was how like my first couple of manuscripts honestly came to be. So this was like throughout the entirety of like high school, this was very like stretched out. I didn't write like a lot because like there wasn't that much time to always be writing, but whenever I was like bored and I wanted to entertain myself, I would just be like throwing things down and like collecting up manuscripts. That was like slowly helping me like get better at writing, I guess. But then I did that for almost like all of my high school days. And then by the time I got to college, I think I was finally like at this point where I was like, well, actually, maybe I can write now. Like, I think I've done it so much that now it does make some logical sense, as opposed to the first few where I was like, oh, I'm just gonna entertain myself. It doesn't have to make sense. So when I wrote These Vandalites, it was the first book that I actually thought did seem like something that could get published, because like I was reading so much as well. So I was like, you know, like I've absorbed so much of what like is actual, like what is appearing on the shelves. This does seem like it could go somewhere. So that was the first book I queried, and it went from there.
That's awesome. I kind of love the idea that you wrote books at first for yourself. Like you wrote them to be messy and you didn't care about that. I feel like that's advice that people try to give authors all the time now, and authors are like, I can't, I'm too stuck in my method and my ways. But like,
yeah,
that's the way to be.
And I think it was because I didn't know any better, because like back then it wasn't like I was plugged into like a circuit or anything of like other people who were taking their craft seriously. Like it didn't even occur to me that it was something I could do. And like in a way I'm really glad I started out like that, because it gave me like the space to really like find what I wanted to do before I like gave myself any pressure to be good at it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And like you have to have fun at some point in the process, right? Because publishing is really rough. So at
rough.
Least while you're writing, if you can like entertain yourself, like you said, make yourself laugh, I think that's really important to try to find joy in those moments. So for anybody who doesn't know what These Violet Delights are about, can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yes. Okay, so my short little pitch is These Violet Delights is a Romeo and Juliet retelling by way of The Godfather, and it's set in 1920s gangster-ruled Shanghai. So the story goes, when a mysterious illness starts devastating the city and rumors speak of a monster being the cause, two former childhood lovers turned enemies from rival gangs have to set aside the blood feud between them and work together and put a stop to it.
I love that.
I love that so much. It has so many things that are like such juicy kind of little tidbits about it.
Mm. Is it dual POV, just from my curiosity, or is it just one POV? Or is it?
It is. It's many. It's like,
ooh.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. Yay. Excited.
And you have a gorgeous cover, I have to say. Like,
love the cover.
Beautiful design.
I love it so much. A+. Honestly, I don't know how the team did it. It's just, it's like magic. They made some deal with some devil. It had to be him. It's beautiful.
Maybe it was Shakespeare's ghost.
Maybe.
Oh my god.
He rose up, he was like, my reputation relies on this.
It's really, really pretty.
It definitely, like, gives great homage to him, even in the title, obviously, the Shakespeare line. And I know that in your bio, it kind of says, like, you obviously adore Romeo and Juliet. It seems like you're a huge champion of this story. So I'm just wondering, like, how did you fall in love with this play exactly? And how did you kind of come up with the idea of setting it in a historical Shanghai setting? Like, how did that click into place for you?
Oh my God. It's honestly, like, kind of wild how it came together, because I hadn't really, like, paid, like it wasn't that I was, like, super, super in love with Romeo and Juliet and then I went the retelling aspect, but rather that I'd always really liked Shakespeare because his use of language is so beautiful. Like, I know, like, because Shakespeare is taught so much in schools, like, in general, people find him really stuffy because, like, honestly, I think a lot of the times he's just not taught well, but that's, like, its whole other, like, tangent. But his language use is just so beautiful, and I love, like, good, like, crunchy, maybe crunchy is the wrong word to use. I love good, like, prose that you can, like, really, like, grab, like, it's just, it feels good to put your eyes on it. So because I, like, loved his, like, sense of work and all that, when I got the idea to, so the first part of the idea for these Valentines that actually came to me was writing about a blood feud. So I was like, well, what can I really do with the story, and what, like, what am I actually trying to say, I guess, was what I was going for. And then, like, in some way, I don't really know how the wires connected, but somehow I was like, well, if I'm going to do a blood feud, maybe I should, like, go to Romeo and Juliet and, like, reimagine it. I feel like that would be cool. Like, that was just my thought process. And then I reread Romeo and Juliet when I decided to do that. And, like, it was on that reread, I was kind of like, wow, Shakespeare really said something in this. Like, he was really making, like, a lot of good points. And I was like, maybe, like, I could do something with this too. So that kind of became, like, the core idea, where I was like, I will write about a blood feud and make it Shakespearean. And then I kind of connected that to 1920 Shanghai, because then I was looking for, like, a setting for it. And a blood feud being, like, so messy and, like, just a lot of violence happening, I was like, this feels suited for the background that of Shanghai that I already know and I'm already really interested in it. So because, like, once I did research into it, it was like, okay, well, there was so much going on at this time. The streets were gangster ruled. There was, like, colonizers everywhere. There was, like, imperialism. There was just all this domestic politics. And I was like, Shakespeare would really love this. So it all meshed together, and it felt very delightfully violent.
Hence the title. So the next question was actually going to be about the era that you chose to put it in, because you made so many interesting choices that I think are what make the premise of the book so appealing. But you said that you did obviously research. What was your research process like? What did you do? Did you do anything interesting or weird? I go on site anywhere? Like, what was that whole process like for you?
It was, so the research on this is, it kind of got split into, like, the historical dimension and then the Shanghai dimension. So because all of my family are from Shanghai, so my parents immigrated with me when I was 2. So I still have, like, a lot of relatives back there. And occasionally, like, when we go back to visit, like, I already, like, know quite a lot about the city. So that was kind of, like, my starting basis. But in all the times that where I did go back, all of my, like, strange field work, I was kind of, like, I would be like to my dad, like, hey, if we have a free day, can we go to like that building from the 1920s? And he'll be like, why? But okay. And like, the good thing is that not much has like changed in modern day Shanghai, because they still like preserve a lot of the like the aesthetic of the buildings, even though like inside, like the atmosphere is completely different. But the funniest part of the research is that I checked out a lot of the like places in the book. Well, actually, I think it was after multiple drafts. I think I was signed with my agent already by the time I was back there, like on vacation, looking around. And the funniest part was there's this one building in the book where the characters are like running for their lives through, like it's like this frantic chase. And I like just described the building as like a regular building. And then I showed up in real life and I walked in and I was like, oh no, this building is donut shaped. Like there's a hollow inside. None of this makes sense. So that was just the most bizarre thing that I didn't think would require research. And yet, so then after that, I like went back and I emailed my agent and I was like, so I'm going to do a tiny revision because the building is hollow. And then I just changed a few lines and sent it back to her. So that was just like the Shanghai part of it. But the actual like research where I actually did seriously was like the historical part of it. Mm-hmm. So because I kind of I do make up a lot of things, but I tried to stick really closely with the actual like timeline when it came to like the civil war that would come up and a lot of like the communist revolution. So because like I didn't have that much knowledge of like the specifics that went on, I would like go sit in the library and just comb through like a lot of the primary sources, which was honestly it's really bizarre, because on one hand I was almost grateful that there was such a heavy foreign presence in Shanghai at the time, because it meant that there were a lot of English sources for me to go through, because like I can't read Chinese very well, so it wasn't that like I could go into the Chinese resources. And then I would just sit there and be like, oh, I'm so mad that there are English sources, because it means that there was just so much colonization. But then I'm so glad I have it so I can learn. It was very just a split opinion.
It's the struggle of the diaspora writer. Like, I want the historical resources, but I also hate what you did to my country.
That sounds
so great and interesting. I'm fascinated by the fact that you literally wrote a scene and had to rewrite it after going to visit the location. I think that's actually really, really cool.
Ride or Die is brought to you in part by Tee Public.
Tee Public is home to independent art on stickers, cases, shirts, and more.
Check out our Write or Die store at teepublic.com/stores/writeordiepodcast.
Check it out now.
I know that obviously you're debuting this year, 2020, and you're also, are you in the United States right now for school?
I am. Okay. I'm living, so my school's technically closed, but I'm living off campus, so they can't kick me off.
Oh gosh. So there's obviously a lot of different things you're juggling right now. You're in your last year of university, you are debuting, you're trying to stay safe. I kind of feel like we are doing this a lot with our 2020 debut guests, but we want to do a mental health check-in, see how you're doing. And also, if you have any self-care tips for our listeners, then feel free to give those as well.
Ooh, that is a good question. I wasn't expecting that. I think my biggest self-care tip is that sometimes I'll just stop, like, I'll stop having like expectations for what I want to do in the day. Like I feel like prior to everything becoming so messy, like I was a very strict, like I'll like stick to this like routine, like in a day, like I have to get this stuff done, I have to get all that stuff done. But like with just the world and chaos, like sometimes I'll be like, I don't really feel like finishing all of this today, which is not to say like I abandoned my homework or anything. Like I'll be like, if I don't really want to do it today, like I'm just going to, I'll like spread it out through the next few weeks. It's not that big of a deal. Like if the world ends, I'm not going to remember my homework. Yeah, it's like,
that's right.
Yeah. It like just, if I feel like it, I'll just lay down and scroll TikTok for like 3 hours. I feel like that's healthier on me than like staring at my essay for 2 hours.
Yeah, I am on board with that. I don't think people should force themselves right now. Especially you're juggling so much. Like you're juggling school, an author career, and like everything being on fire. So it's not easy. It's definitely not. I like those tips. I've noticed on Twitter that people are already sort of like picking sides for your book. Like people who can you explain a little bit what's going on there? What side should I pick? Like where would me and Kat go first of all? And
oh, yeah,
like
sort us into the sides.
Oh my god, this is so.
And did you expect people to like get into it this soon? Like people are like yelling about it already. I really like seeing that.
It's amazing. It's on 10. I love it.
I'm like really pleased. Like I really didn't expect people to like get so passionate about it, but they're like really like up. Like Zoe Hannah, who's a 2021 debut, uploaded a video of herself throwing a knife, and I was like, damn, I just this is real bloodfeed stuff.
It's so cool.
Yeah, I was shook. But yeah, it was kind of, I wanted to make it sort of like a street team kind of thing, but like more casual because I didn't like want the big commitment of it. So I was just like, yeah, guys, sign up. You can choose Scarlet Gang or White Flowers, which is the two gangs in the book, which, so Juliet belongs to the Scarlet Gang and Roma belongs to the White Flowers. And I honestly didn't even really describe them, but then people just picked sides and now they're like willing to like die for the side. And I was like, this is amazing. I am so beholden to witness this. Let me think. I don't know what, I don't know if it's because Clarabelle, you're like pink hair aesthetic, but I feel like you would like vibe with the Scarlet Gang. Like for the, that. Just for the like, red pink aesthetic. And then I feel like by virtue Kat should be White Flowers, so you guys can have like a star-crossed
we can fight, you
know, vibe. Yeah.
I like that.
Fights are like over who like gets the last chicken nugget.
I was just gonna say it's about chicken. It's always about chicken nuggets. It's really, that's like what you boil down our personalities to. It's like chicken nuggets and our love of chicken nuggets. And now I really want chicken nuggets. So
no,
thank
the fight
you.
Has begun. I love that like Clarabelle and I can never be the same thing. Because anytime anyone sorts us, they're like, you have to be different things. And I was like, why can't we be the same thing? But I kind of like it. I kind of like how it forces us to, like, really choose sides. What side would you take, Chloe? If you had to, you have to pick it.
Oh, my God. I truly, honestly, it's so tough. I feel like, oh, my God, no, when does this go live? Because I feel like if this goes live while it's going on, people are going to be like, yes, victory for this side.
This goes out November 30th. Okay. So instead of picking a side, tell us your like number one favorite thing about each gang.
This is a much easier question. I think my favorite thing about the Scarlet Gang would be their aesthetic, because they're very much, they're old. So they've been around for a long time. So they have like their mansions, like outside of the city. They have their like burlesque clubs. They have their like cabarets. So all of that, like with the like dripping scarlet red, kind of like red and gold, all of that. It's just very like, it's very visually pleasing when I like see it in my mind's eye. And I think my favorite thing about the White Flowers is how just out there they are, because they're the new ones in this. Well, they're not new. They've been here for a few generations as well. But their backstory is that they came in fleeing Russian civil unrest. So the majority of them are Russian. And because of that, like, they, like, find their place in the city in, like, the apartment blocks. They're very, like, congregated together. They don't have, like, a hierarchy like the Scarlet Gang do. They're very, like, I'll fight my way up to the top. So I like them for their attitude.
They're more, it seems like they're more chaotic.
Mm. Wait, so does this mean that you find Claribel beautiful and me chaotic?
In the best way.
Chaotic is a compliment in this house.
It is. Yeah, that's actually a legit compliment. I will take it.
Okay, Chloe, so everyone who's been on the podcast tells us either their most embarrassing publishing-related story or something they wish they'd known before they started. You could do either or, you could do both. It's up to you.
So I actually tried really, really hard to think of an embarrassing story because I loved hearing, like, other people's embarrassing stories. But I think the tragic thing is because lockdown in 2020 happened so early, like, most of my, like, author career just hasn't, like, I haven't associated with anyone, like, in real life, so I've had less chances to be embarrassing, which I'm really upset about because now I don't have a story. So
you want to make one right now? Let's do something embarrassing. Let's do it.
I don't even know what to do to embarrass myself. I just, my entire existence, I guess, is embarrassing enough, but, like, no like one incident. Yeah, so I guess I have to go with what I wish I knew, which that I do have something for. Not so much in the sense that, like, it's some, like, big lesson that I wish I learned, but, like, something that, like, me just starting out, like, in the, like, writing community, like, I wish I knew, actually, that it's quite small. And, like, once you actually, like, sort of get into it, like, it's really easy just to be, like, oh, like, you know so-and-so? Oh, I know so-and-so. And then it's, like, it just feels very, like, small. And it's, like, a comforting thing rather than a, like, big, scary. No, it wouldn't be a big, scary thing. It's a comforting thing rather than, like, a, ooh, you know so-and-so, if that makes sense. Like, it's, like...
Comforting more than intimidating, maybe?
Yeah, yeah. Like, once you know a few people in the publishing industry, like, you know a lot more people than you think you do. And it's like, it just feels very, like, tight-knit and more than, you know, this big thing that you can't really understand once you're in.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think a lot of people don't realize, like, how small it is. And I think once you go to, like, a real, an in-person conference, that becomes, like, really evident, especially one of the big ones where you can literally see almost every single person from, it's, like, highly visible on Book Twitter.
It's like, hey, my entire timeline.
It's quite funny. That's why I always, like, tell people, like, hey, don't say anything on Twitter that you wouldn't say to someone's face if you're an author, because you're probably going to see them at some point. So just be okay with that. And if you are, that's cool. But, like, just know it's going to happen.
Bring up the most random things that you'll say on Twitter. And you'll be like, you were paying attention? Oh, no.
No. You know what's the weirdest thing? We talk so much on this podcast. I remember what I say. I really don't. And people will be like, you know, in this episode where you said this thing, it was just like, it really resonated with me. And I'm like, uh-huh. Like, I can't be expected to remember both my books and everything that I say on here. It's impossible.
It's so hard. But that's the thing, too, is like, it's so funny because there are a lot of authors who, like, you'll go up to them, you'll be like, oh, what did you mean with this side character that showed up in your book that you wrote 3 years ago? And they're like looking at you like, what the hell are you talking about? And you're like, oh, you have no idea who this character is anymore. You have moved past it and I have not. And I am okay with that. That's okay. But I think it's, yeah, but it's cool. I like it. I like how, you know, interested we are in each other's opinions. It can backfire sometimes, but
yeah, no community is perfect. You know what I mean? And especially like when you're learning the ropes, like when you're first starting out, and like when we started on Book Twitter, it was the Wild West. Like, it's
no one knew what the hell they were doing.
So much tamer than it used to be, I'll tell you that much. And it was even worse before that. Like one Twitter generation before us, it was even worse. So, yeah, Twitter's weird, but we're glad you're there. I enjoy your shit posting, Chloe.
Oh, yeah,
it's so funny.
Thank you. I take pride in it.
Yeah, your Twitter presence is quite the delight. So I would say keep on keeping on, because you're definitely doing something right there.
It's quite the delight, because she's quite the author of these. I think we're talking delights.
About old timey things. I've morphed into like a gentleman. Scholar from the 1920s.
You're such a weirdo. Why would you say that?
Let me live my life. Right? Okay. White
Chicken Nugget.
Scarlet Gang. The we're taking feud. It to the street. The
blood feud.
Yeah. Blood feud, Clarabelle. We're fighting. And
I'm literally gonna win, bro. Chicken Nugget. I'm established. My aesthetic is on point.
Yeah, you're old. Your time is done. Okay?
Old means wise. Okay. Being young just means you don't know shit.
Means denial. The white flowers are coming for you. I cannot.
Come then. We're gonna take this to
That's
Twitter.
The battle cry. That's the battle cry.
Come then.
Come at me, bro.
Okay, Chloe. It has been a delight to have you on the podcast.
It How has many not times have we said delight?
What? Say my words, Clarabelle.
We've said delight so many times.
It's been wonderful to have you on the podcast. It's been amazing. It's been a feast for our ears.
You opened the thesaurus.com.
I know. But let me get to my point. Let everyone know where they can find you on the internet.
They can find me living everywhere on the internet. I am at the Chloe Gong just about everywhere. Twitter, Instagram, TikTok. I think that's it. And my website. Yes.
Amazing.
Yay.
And so by the time this goes up, the book, These Violence Delight, whoa, my goodness, words. Because I'm so heated still. Let me try that again. By the time this episode is up, These Violent Delights will be in bookstores everywhere. So you guys know what to do. Buy your prerequisite 20 copies.
20 copies.
It's required. So thank you so much, Chloe, for being on the podcast. We had so much fun, even
so
though now Clarabelle and I must fight to the death.
We're going to fight. Whoever wins gets chicken nuggets. Of course. And best of luck with debut and with school and everything. We hope it goes amazing.
Thank you. It was my pleasure to make you two blood enemies.
This is your doing, Chloe.
When Ride or Die turns into like the chaos that it is, everyone can track it back to this episode.
This moment, this very moment.
Thanks for listening to Ride or Die.
Be sure to check out Wicked Fox by Kat Cho.
And Ghost Squad by Clarabelle A. Ortega. And while you're at it, make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us a review. See you next time, Wordies.
And don't forget to spread the word.